Well, hello everyone. I'm Edward Mills, the Director of TeleSummits here at the Shift Network, and we're back for another session of the Healthy Money Summit. Today's sessions are being hosted by Hazel Henderson. We've had great sessions already with Catherine Collins and John Fullerton. This session she'll be in conversation with Ellen Brown, who she'll introduce in just a moment. And we'll be back at 3 p.m. Pacific time with Donna Hamlin, another amazing session. And tomorrow, Susan Davis will be here with four sessions to wrap up the Healthy Money Summit tomorrow, so don't miss the sessions tomorrow on conscious investing. Also wanted to remind you that you can leave comments, your insights, your thoughts, your questions on our program page. Go to healthymoneysummit.com/program, and you can scroll down, click the button that says add a comment, and you'll be able to add your comments so that we can see them, and you can connect with others from all around the world. Also, when Hazel does get ready to take questions later in the call, if you are on the phone and you want to ask a question live, press *2 at that time and it'll raise your hand and we'll be able to call on you. All right, let me go ahead and introduce Hazel and then she'll introduce Ellen and we'll get right into it. Hazel Henderson is a futurist, evolutionary economist, and author of more than 9 books, including the Axiom and Nautilus Award-winning book, Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy. She's the founder of Ethical Markets Media and the creator of its TV series, and her editorials are syndicated by Interpress Service, with articles appearing in journals such as the Harvard Business Review, New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, and many international publications as well. You can find out more about Hazel at www.hazelhenderson.com. Hazel Henderson, and Henderson is with an O on the end, hazelhenderson.com. And also a lot of what they'll be talking about, you can find more information about at www.ethicalmarkets.com. That's ethicalmarkets.com. And both of those links are available on the program page. Hazel, thank you so much for being here for the second day of the Healthy Money Summit. It's such a pleasure to have you here hosting these amazing sessions.
Well, thank you, Ed. So welcome, everybody, to the Healthy Money Summit from me, which, as you know, is a production of the Shift Network. And I'm Hazel Henderson, and we're so glad that you're joining us. And note that you are welcome to submit comments on the summit program page or just raise your hand, and if you want to talk directly on the phone, we'll be here. I am so excited to introduce our special guest today, the amazing Ellen Brown. And Ellen is an attorney and president of the Public Banking Institute and the author of 11 books and over 200 articles. Ellen is really a major global public intellectual. She's everywhere, advising governments and central bankers, and her book, The Web of Debt, shows how a private cartel of bankers usurp the power to create money from the people themselves, and how we, the people, can get it back. And Ellen has a new book coming out shortly called The Buck Starts Here. And I have read an early copy of it, and it's full of all the solutions that we need. And Ellen really specializes in restoring abundance. I was talking with John a little bit earlier about the fact that it really is an abundant universe. And Ellen really knows pathways to help us to reach that abundance. So welcome, Ellen, and thank you so much for joining us. And first, I'd like to fully disclose, the way I've been doing all along, that Ellen serves on the Ethical Markets Advisory Board, and I serve on the advisory board of the Public Banking Institute that Ellen founded. So you can also find all her articles on our website. And so, Ellen, let's begin by asking you a little bit more about your personal story and how you, as a lawyer, became interested in how the Federal Reserve System came to give away our constitutional right over coining our money to the private banking system. Let's start right there.
Thanks, Hazel, for the lovely introduction. Well, I actually was interested in that before I was a lawyer. My first degree was wanted to write. There were several subjects that interested me, and that was one. I had done some research on it, but I didn't was young, you know, I was in my 20s, and I didn't really know what I could add to the subject. And at that time, we didn't have the internet, and I would pose questions to myself, and I couldn't really get to the answers because you'd go to the library and the book would be out or something. The data wasn't there. So then I was a lawyer for 10 years, and then my ex-husband burned out on Beverly Hills Law and decided he wanted to go in the Foreign Service, which gave me an opportunity to write. So we were in the Foreign Service for 11 years, during which I wrote 10 books. And then I learned in the course of, I had written on health and the politics of health, and I learned in the course of all that that I had considered the antagonist in my plot lines as the drug or the pharmaceutical, cancer, medical, industrial complex. And when I learned that the banking industry was part of that whole cartel, and that where they got their power was that they actually had the power to create money, then I could see that if you really wanted to solve the problem, you had to go for the banks and the whole banking system. And the more I looked into it, the more shocking it was, and how you could just see that when you're talking about abundance, that where we've lost our abundance is that there's a tourniquet on the power of the people to create their own credit. And credit is just something that should go along with productivity. It should come into existence as productivity does. I mean, it's just a means of exchange. If you've got things out there, workers and materials, and they're available, there's no reason you can't get them together to produce something. But we're limited by our inability to get this thing called money, which we have to borrow from banks. And banks get this huge amount of interest off that. But then when I actually decided to write on it was when I learned that The Wizard of Oz was written as a monetary allegory in the 1890s. And that was just so fascinating that it gave me my hook. And so I wove that whole book, Web of Debt, around The Wizard of Oz and the whole populist movement, which I think we should have again, or you can see a budding populist movement now, 100 years later.
We certainly can. And your book is just unbelievable. It's an incredible revelation, and I recommend it to anybody. And you've just done an article, which we are posting, it should be up tomorrow, called It's the Interest, Stupid. So tell us more about how the process of compound interest, which I know my friend Professor Margaret Kennedy in Germany spent most of her life looking at the role of compound interest, but you and she now have been communicating. And tell us more about what's in this incredibly interesting article.
Yes, I started out with her book, Occupy Money, which it just came out in the 2012 edition. I actually met her in Croatia at a conference, but we had communicated before that, and I love her work. It's so interesting. So she has found that 35 to 40% of everything we buy goes for interest. She's basing that on some German publications that are go back to the Bundesbank. And so, of course, we can't really read the original, but you can see that that's true just from the fact that we know that mortgages, by the end of your 30 years, you will have paid at least as much again in interest as you paid in principal. But so she points out that at every stage of production, producers, businesses borrow in order to pay their workers and materials before they have a product to sell. And before they get paid, they don't get paid till 90 days net, usually, from their end buyer. So all that time, they're funding their business on credit. And then there are many different businesses in the whole chain. So, and they all add their cost of money, the cost of borrowing, to their cost or to their price, which they then pass the product onto the next stage in that whole chain. And so when you add all those up, you get 35 to 40%, which is a huge chunk. And that is being siphoned off into capital accounts of bankers, particularly, there are, of course, two types of bankers. There are the small local bankers who really do turn that back into the local economy, which is a good thing. But the ones that are not so good are the big Wall Street banks that are siphoning those profits off, putting them into tax exempt. Into offshore tax havens, which we now just learned there's $21 to $32 trillion in these tax havens. So this whole idea that this whole trickle down idea that if you give it to the wealthy, they will put it back into the economy in the form of adding jobs is just not true. It's a parasite on the side of the economy that's just sucking assets out, and they are not putting them back in.
Well, it's very interesting, you know, because in my second book, Politics of the Solar Age, I sort of stumbled upon the same issue of interest. And I realized that compound interest is mathematically impossible in nature. There's no such thing as compound interest. I mean, basically, it becomes an exponential cost that underlies everything. So I came up with a similar kind of understanding of this thing, but you're really the one who dug into it very much more deeply. You know, I went on to other things, and then discovering your work, it really brought it home to me again, you know, that it's a multiplier in absolutely everything that we buy. And so this really relates to all of this amazingly good work that you've done on the need to go back to public banking, which we used to have. And talk more about that, you know, many countries still do have publicly owned banks where the interest that's paid, instead of going offshore into tax havens, goes back to the citizenry, goes back to the public treasury. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, in fact, the original model was the Bank of Pennsylvania, the Colony of Pennsylvania in Benjamin Franklin's time, where the colony could issue the money. They used paper script. They didn't have gold, and the other alternative was to borrow banknotes from the British bankers who were charging interest and didn't really have the gold either. They were issuing many more banknotes than they had gold. So the Pennsylvanians set up their own bank where they would issue a certain amount of money and then lend it to the farmers, and then the money would come back, principal and interest. And meanwhile, that they could spend a little extra of this money. That, say you started with $105, you could lend $100 at 5% interest, spend $5, and then it would all come back as principal and interest. You could lend the $100 again, spend the $5 again, and it would all come back. So you would have a sustainable system. It wouldn't have to grow exponentially to cover the interest, because you're putting the interest out there at the same time that you're putting the principal out there. You're spending it into the economy. And that worked very well. They did not pay taxes during that time. They did not have price inflation, and they did not have any debt. They had some inflation due to lack of commodities, scarcity, but not due to inflating the money supply, because they weren't inflating the money supply.
So, you know, I've always been sympathetic with Ron Paul and his followers, because I think that a lot of his diagnosis of the problem with the Fed and everything else, and just what you're talking about, is correct, you know, in his book and the Fed. And the only thing where I part company with him is that he says, oh, we have to go back to the gold standard. And that is, there's all kinds of very, very good reasons why that would be disastrous and we don't need it. But basically, talk about what you discovered in North Dakota.
We have one state that does own its own bank. It's owned its bank since 1919. It was the only state that escaped the 2008 credit crisis and has had a nice surplus every year since then. They have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate on loans, and the lowest foreclosure rate in the country. I think they're down to 3% unemployment.
This is before the oil rush, right?
And
this was long before that.
Right. They've been doing quite well for decades, but you could even, they do have oil, and that's one reason that I've written about public banks globally and historically, because 40% of banks globally are publicly owned. These are largely in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which also escaped the 2008 banking crisis that was supposedly a global crisis. So there's a lot of evidence that this model works much better. I mean, the whole, if you just think about it, what we're talking about here is returning the profits to the people instead of siphoning them off. And that does allow us to create virtually anything we want to create. And that's what the Australians did with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. They just issued the credit for whatever they wanted. This was between 1912 and 1923, and they did remarkable things.
And then how was that repealed, or it was sort of captured by the banking industry in Australia, rather the same way as the private banks captured the Federal Reserve and set that up here in 1913?
Well, the head of the bank, the governor of the bank, Dennison Miller, was... he was a banker himself, and so when they appointed him the head of this public bank, he knew what you could do as a bank, which is create credit on your books. That's what banks do. But he used this in the public interest, including funding World War I without borrowing from the British bankers. But his mistake was that he went to London after that and he bragged about it. And he said, anything the Australian people want, we can create. We've got the credit for it. We'll draw on the credit of the people. And we don't even need to borrow, you know, for wars. Well, this is quite alarming to the City of London, because that was how they were holding on to their colonies. They were capturing them financially, although they had lost them politically. Mm-hmm. And so they quickly got together and devised another system, where it was the central banking system that we have today, where originally the Bank of England was to be the head of this system, and then the central banks would create the currencies of the countries and lend them to the government, rather than the government itself creating its own currency.
I think that what you write about in this article about what the case of France right now, where for the longest time France had a publicly owned central bank, and they didn't get into all of this tremendous debt. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that was very interesting. You've got some very good charts in this article, too.
I think that came from Bernard Leotard's book.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 1973. Before 1973, the French and the Canadians borrowed from their own central bank. In other words, they funded their government interest-free. They weren't printing the money per se, but they were borrowing from a bank that they owned, and therefore the interest went back to the government. And during that period, both the French and the Canadians had very low, steady public debt. And then in 1973, that was when the whole system changed, and the Bank for International Settlements formed this committee that established these new rules, which were that you weren't supposed to borrow from your own bank, and you weren't supposed to print money. You were supposed to borrow from the international bankers, on the theory that this would be not inflationary because you were borrowing existing money. Of course, the flaw in the theory is that bankers themselves are all just creating the money on their books, but now you have to pay interest to the bank instead of getting the interest back because you just borrowed from your own bank.
See, I think a lot of people still don't really understand that banks create our money simply with the stroke of a pen. Whenever you go and borrow, get a mortgage, it isn't that the bank takes that, however many $100,000 you're borrowing, from somebody else in somebody else's account and give it to you. All they do is they just post an entry into your account saying, boom, you know, here you have this money, and so basically they just create it out of thin air. I mean, most people absolutely don't understand that. I remember John Kenneth Galbraith when he wrote that book about money, where it goes and where it went, or and he was saying if anybody actually understood the way money was created, you know, they would be just totally horrified. But it's been a closely kept sort of secret. But it's all out in the open now because we see money being printed on TV almost every day. You know, central bankers are trying to inflate the old system and bail out the past and all the past mistakes. Well, it wouldn't be any problem if they decided to invest in the future, like green energy and infrastructure that we need and schools, you know, free higher education the way they have in most European countries. So, you know, it's just a huge subject. And if we don't understand this subject, we don't really get to the heart of understanding everything we're going through in this transition.
Mm-hmm. But I think you've nailed it there, that's why this is such an exciting time, that, you know, we've seen through what they're up to. We've seen what banking is. We've seen where credit comes from, where money comes from. It's created on the books of banks, and it's issued for their purposes. So all we have to do is take back the banks, and we can do that for public purposes. We can have all the abundance that we can have, like the Australian said, everything that we can imagine that's productive and good for the people.
So that's why you founded the Public Banking Institute. And tell us, you've got things going now in what? The last time I looked, 14 different states where they're thinking about reinstating the idea of public banks. I know you considered the case of California. And at the end of 2010, it had a debt of $158 billion. And of that, $70 billion, 44% of it was interest. And if the state had incurred that debt to its own California State Bank, which would then return the profits to the, you know, to the state's budget, California could be $70 billion richer today, is what you're saying. Instead of slashing services and selling off public assets and laying off employees, it could be adding the services and repaying the decaying infrastructure. So tell us how the Public Banking Institute is working with so many states now, with bills being introduced to set up public banks again. Give us an idea of where you're going on that, Ellen. It's very inspiring work.
Thanks. There are actually 20 states now that have introduced bills of one sort or another for publicly owned banks. One of them is an initiative, which I actually think is a good idea, but we need more public understanding of the issues before we could get an initiative passed. We haven't actually passed any of these bills, which is a little frustrating, but we're learning what they're going to say, and there's even more interest in pursuing them. So we know how to respond now. We may have said some wrong things the first time around, and we know how to say it better this time, or what the real perks are here. One thing the bankers respond to, and what the small bankers, you know, we know what they're looking for, what excites them about this whole idea, and what the municipal governments get excited about. One thing that you can do with a public bank, many municipalities or city governments, county governments have fallen for these interest rate swaps, which have just sucked the money out of their budgets. Like Oakland, that's the reason their schools are closing. I mean, the whole school education system is disastrous in California. When I went to school, Berkeley was free, and that was under Pat Brown, Jerry Brown's father. So I know Jerry Brown has some of those principles instilled in him, and it's the basic New Deal mentality that we're free education is part of our heritage.
It's the basic investment that any society makes in its future. If you don't invest in educating and making healthy future generation, I mean, a country has no future.
Mm-hmm. So these cities have fallen for these interest rate swaps with Wall Street. When they want to fund anything, they issue a bond, and to get the bond, they have to go to Wall Street, and then Wall Street says, first of all, they have to pay money for the bond issue, and then the Wall Street bank will say, well, you'll need some of these interest rate swaps as insurance to protect your interest rate. Well, it turned out they're not really insurance. They're a bet, and the bet went the wrong way intentionally. It was the Federal Reserve that forced the interest rates down ridiculously low to 0.25% for the banks. And so these cities all lost out. Well, what they do in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota issues credit lines to municipalities, and they fund these bonds. So they have a guaranteed partner there with a big bank that is a friend, that it's the mandate of the Bank of North Dakota to serve the public. And so they help these municipalities. They help they don't make a profit, or the profit goes back to the state.
So it cuts out the Wall Street middlemen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there must be a lot of pushback, because many, many states will put their tax receipts into an escrow account like at Bank of America or JP Morgan Chase or Wells Fargo or whoever. And so if somebody like the Public Banking Institute comes along and says, well, look, you know, there's no need to put your tax receipts into a Wall Street bank. You can put your tax receipts into a bank that the state owns. And if you're one of those big Wall Street banks, you are going to be mad and you are going to push back. So what's been happening on that front?
The whole move your money idea is a good idea for the local community. But in fact, the Wall Street banks don't need our money. They now have $1.6 trillion in excess reserves sitting on their books because of all this quantitative easing that the Federal Reserve is doing.
Which is basically free, right? I mean, it's like printing money and giving it to the banks free.
Well, no, they're actual swaps, so they swapped them for something that was on their books.
Basically the interest rate that they pay.
But this, yeah, the 0.25% is so low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's supposed to trickle down, isn't it? That's the theory. Dear old Ben Bernanke, you know, reading from the old textbook, it says, oh, well, you pour these new funds into the top of these big Wall Street banks, and they trickle down and fund all of the enterprises and the homeowners on Main Street. But we know that in a global economy, they send that money overseas, and it gets used. I know my colleagues in Brazil get really upset about this, you know, that it's pumping up asset prices, creating bubbles in Brazil, and it's employing people in China, you know, or it's going for bets on credit default swaps about which European countries' sovereign bonds are going to default.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it doesn't trickle down. And so that leads me to help us all understand how it is really that what's been happening the last 4 years, which we are euphemistically told is a great recession, which is just mystification really, because as you've pointed out, what it really is the money supply domestically has collapsed. Because if the banks, normally we rely on private banks to create our money supply as loans, and then there was this huge securitization where they packaged up the mortgages and sold them to unsuspecting pension funds, that's all collapsed. And so the real problem is that our domestic money supply has collapsed. So people don't have the cash circulating to pay their employees and I know you've explained that so clearly, Ellen.
Right. It's the shadow banking system is the part that collapsed, and so we don't really see that. It's not reported anymore. They only report M1 and M2. It's pretty difficult to explain what the shadow banking system is, but it's the large institutional investors have way more money than $250,000, so they don't want to put it in a regular bank with FDIC insurance, which only covers $250,000. So they put it in the repo market, which is backed by these mortgage-backed securities. That's why there was this huge demand for mortgages, which they chopped up and could sell off to investors, and they didn't care who they were giving these mortgages to. They were just feeding this giant repo market that then collapsed because it's a one-day deal, just like your deposit account. The big investors want to be able to pull their money out overnight. And so when Lehman Brothers collapsed, the money market investors all pulled their money out at once, and the money market collapsed. And that is where the banks get their money when they can't get it anywhere else. They go to the money market, or when, you know, they don't have the deposits, they go to the money market. And so credit froze globally because interest rates shot up beyond where it was profitable to make loans.
So how are we going to get our money supply back? You know, we know that the collapse of the domestic money supply is what caused the so-called Great Recession. But how are we going to get our money supply flowing? Because it's not going to happen with Bernanke keeps printing money and giving it to big banks, because it'll keep going overseas.
Mm-hmm. There's this really inspiring documentary on Franklin Roosevelt called FDR that we were just watching. They don't ever mention where he got the money, but Hoover had the same mentality as Ben Bernanke and as the current very nervous, fearful administration, where they're afraid, you know, they put the money in these sterilized accounts. They say, well, we're going to print money, but we're not going to let it out because that would inflate the money supply. So, but we want to inflate the money supply. But when Roosevelt came along, he said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. You know, he just broke out of that constraint and just started doing everything in sight that was profitable for the country, that would put people to work. I mean, they hired artists. They did these wonderful buildings, these post offices with paintings and sayings over the door. It was so inspiring. I mean, it was a whole culture that we don't have anymore. And they were flat broke. I mean, they were in a much worse depression than we are now. And they just did it. They went out there and did it. But how? They had their own bank, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. It was not the Federal Reserve, which was not cooperating. They were just as nervous as they are now. But it was this other financial institution run by Jesse Jones. Roosevelt did not have to go to Congress to get their approval. He just went to the RFC, and they funded everything. And so what they did was, they borrowed originally from the Treasury, and then the Treasury gave them carte blanche to do whatever they wanted, and then the Treasury would issue bonds. So basically they were funding it through, it was like a development bank. That's the way a development mm-hmm. bank works.
And they did the same thing for housing, for homeowners, didn't they? You know, if we had done the same thing for the underwater homeowners, as they did, as FDR did, we could have avoided all of these millions of foreclosures.
Exactly. It's a mentality thing. You just have to do it. Just go out there and do it. Issue the money and then back it with, you can issue bonds at a modest interest rate. The people will buy the bonds. There's all this money on the sidelines, as they say, that doesn't know where to go. They want some nice, safe government bonds that they could invest in that was doing something good for the country. It's like Liberty Bonds of the 1940s. It's sort of your patriotic duty. It would be lovely to buy some bonds in the Bank of California, for example. I'd invest in that.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the bit of a bright spot now is all the green bonds that are out there. And even the World Bank is issuing green bonds now, and I know the Treasurer of the State of California is buying them. But there's also Green Victory bonds that our friends at Co-op, Green America, are getting through the Congress. I think they will definitely get through now. And there's a whole movement that we report on ethical markets, on green bonds, climate-related bonds, infrastructure bonds. So I think that the world is coming around to realizing we don't just have to sit in despair, but we do have to understand what money is. And once people understand, you know, that money isn't the same as wealth, you know, that it's just an accounting unit that tracks the real wealth, then there's no reason at all, you know, why we shouldn't fund the future that we want. And so in all of this, when you started examining the mortgage situation, and all of these unnecessary foreclosures and everything else, you know, I'd just been doing a review of Sheila Bair's new book. She was the head of the FDIC. Mm-hmm. And her new book is great, called Bull by the Horns. And she's talking about all of this, too, how all the foreclosures were totally unnecessary, that we could have done exactly what FDR did. But as you began writing about this, Ellen, I remember when you were here, we had our Transforming Finance conference back in 2010, you had just broken the story about MERS. Talk a little bit about MERS.
MERS is the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems. It's an electronic database that has allowed this whole mortgage-backed security industry to happen, but it's also destroyed the county records of real estate. More than half of the homes in the country are now recorded in the name of MERS, which, and then all this shifty stuff goes on behind it where they keep buying and selling bits of your house. Your mortgage has been sold over and over, maybe to 10 different sets of investors at the same time. They sort of use it like fractional reserve lending, where they take the mortgages and then they lend it out to different sets of investors, and then they pay them off with one set of mortgages. It's actually a pyramid scheme or a Ponzi scheme. Not that's the way Lehman. I mean, there's evidence that it's been done that way. I don't know if it's always done that way, but you can't tell what's going on behind the smoke screen, and meanwhile, nobody can track the actual the title of their properties. So courts have increasingly been holding that MERS breaks the chain of title. It's not the true beneficiary under the mortgage and the deed of trust, and that the way the thing is done, the mortgage is split from the deed of trust. It gets a little complicated. But anyway, courts are holding that if MERS is in your chain of title, it breaks the chain of title. That means nobody has title. So
that means you could just sit in your own house and nobody could actually throw you out, right?
Well, it means that in theory. But the problem is, first of all, it's not all jurisdictions. But that's true in Oregon, for example. The Oregon Supreme Court has so held, and the Washington State Supreme Court has so held. The California Supreme Court has sort of held the other way, although it's a bit vague. It was for a particular situation. But so it depends on your jurisdiction. But the problem is that individuals generally just don't have the attorney's fees to fight this. You're going to have to go to court. In California, it's a non-judicial foreclosure state, which means that the bank can just foreclose. They don't have to go into court. So who are you going to prove it to? You've got to drag the bank into court, which means you've got to jump through all the hoops. You're up against a huge attorney staff. They can paper you to death. I mean, I'm an attorney, and I wouldn't want to take on one of those cases.
Well, you know, I remember. You remember in Ohio, Toledo, where Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, who is absolutely wonderful, and she told the people in her district, if somebody comes to foreclose on your house and they cannot produce the mortgage, the actual document with your signature on it, if they can't produce that, they can't foreclose. And she said, just stay in your house and lock the doors and tell them to go away.
Yeah, well, that must be a judicial foreclosure state where they have to. Once they sue you, you can, in court, then you as a defendant can then produce that as a defense. in demand to see the documents, et cetera, and assuming you have a favorable judge, you could win, and that has happened. But it seems to me a much better tool would be if we had a county bank or a large entity that was set up in the public interest. In San Bernardino, they're actually looking into this, where the county would take properties by eminent domain, not even the ones that are in foreclosure, but just the ones that are underwater, because it's the underwater properties that have just ruined the property values in San Bernardino County, and the city of San Bernardino has filed for bankruptcy. So they're really quite desperate and ready to try something different.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so if you had a big entity that was willing to fight for the people collectively, then first of all, if you do it by eminent domain, that puts the burden on the banks to prove. You can advertise, put in the local paper, we're going to take these properties by eminent domain. Anyone who can prove title, we will pay fair market value. So that puts the burden on the bank. They have to go into court and demonstrate that they have title. But in at least in those jurisdictions that have ruled that MERS breaks the chain of title, they won't be able to prove it, and then the county would get the homes.
They would allow people to stay in them and pay rent. Isn't that the idea?
Yes, they could work it out various ways. They could sell them back to the homeowners at fair market value, or they would have the creditors that would have a claim, but it's an unsecured claim, and it's only for actual money that they can prove that they're out of pocket. And in general, these investors have been covered by credit default swaps, which means they've already been paid. They've been paid by the party on the other side of the derivative.
Yeah.
So they haven't actually lost money. So
the only thing that's really new, I think, in this country is Occupy Wall Street. And they've been helping, they've been working with these groups that in various, I know here in Florida, in South Florida, where they've been sort of surrounding a house that people are being foreclosed on. And they've now put out a debt resistors manual, which is very, very expert. And they've had, you know, what's been happening with Occupy Wall Street is all of these lovely young women who used to work for the big banks are the ones who've dropped out. I'm so proud of them all because they've, you know, foregone a lot of big salaries. And and they are working with Occupy Wall Street and putting out all these marvelous, well-reasoned, researched manuals about how to deal with the SEC and how to resist unwarranted debt collectors. And so Occupy Wall Street is alive and well, but it's sort of gone national. Now, the last thing I want to really touch on, which is very exciting, I think, is the student debt problem, where student debt now is about $1 trillion. It's more than all of the credit card debt. And, I come from a European country, and most European countries and many countries in the world, public education is free because it's so important. And here we load our students with all of this debt, and then there's no jobs for them. And so tell us what you have been doing in terms of student debt and that whole situation.
Well, it is unbelievable what we've done to our students, that they come out of college now with maybe $40,000-$50,000 in debt. If you went through law school, you could come out $200,000 in debt. And you're either forced to get a job at a big sweatshop firm, which you might hate, or you might not be able to get a job. You're lucky if you can get one of those jobs, and you might not get a job at all, and then you can't get out of it through bankruptcy. There's no way you can get out of these debts. I actually read a good article that suggested that they, whoever they is, don't really want our kids to be educated because it's in the colleges that's where the free thinkers develop, where they start to see through their government and they see the power structure and they see,
oh,
that's
wow.
where revolutions begin.
Well,
but anyway,
I think,
what? Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. I think, well, we, you know, I'm just realizing that we need to give people an opportunity to ask some questions. So,
I'll say that real quick then. So what you could do is do what the Federal Reserve did, where they issued $1 trillion in quantitative easing and bought mortgage-backed securities off the books of the banks, which are securities. These are little pieces of paper. And they could instead have bought $1 trillion in student debt, which is also an asset-backed security, a piece of paper. It's all been securitized, and just rip it up. And it would actually help the whole economy, because those are the people that you want to get the money in their pockets. Those are the people that are going to go out there and shop. What we need is more demand. It's demand that creates jobs. You have to have the customers first, and then the businesses will hire more people to make more shoes to satisfy the shoe customers.
And I think of all that energy, getting those students out from under those unrepayable debts. Wow. So anyway, let's just see if there's any questions out there that people have. Ed?
Great. Well, if you're live on the phone line with us and you have a question or comment for Ellen, just press star 2 on your phone keypad and we can take your question live. If you're listening on the webcast, you can type your question into the box at the lower left of the screen and submit it there. Or you can go and post your question on our program page at healthymoneysummit.com/program. But actually, we've had a number of interesting questions coming in throughout the session. Let's take this one. What are Ellen's thoughts on Greece's alternative currencies that are springing up, such as the TEM in Volos?
Alternative currencies are great for expanding the money supply, particularly when you don't have another. In crisis times, Argentina is a prime example. In 2001, their currency completely collapsed. They just didn't have a currency. And so they managed to turn the whole economy around by, at the local level, they had community currencies where people just issued these little paper receipts and traded among themselves. At the city, county level, they issued IOUs. They paid their workers in IOUs, which they then accepted in the payment of taxes, and that made them a legitimate currency, and it circulated in the economy. And at the national level, they issued pesos. So they issued they went back to their own, before that they were dollarized. So they just printed pesos and started paying for all the things they needed. And 4 years later, they had shown remarkable growth contrary to what everybody predicted. So I think that's what Greece should do. They should go back to the drachma, go at the local level, have local community currencies, and just they need to get some currency out there so they can pay for things and get the economy going again.
And they can still stay in the euro for cross-border. A clearing cross-border accounts. I mean, I think that the whole idea that you have only one currency doesn't make any sense. You know, the clearing local markets, you know, with currencies at the town level, the city level, the regional level, I think this is the way to go. And then they can still stay in the euro. This is, I think, what our friend Bernard Leitier, I just did a review of his book, Money and Sustainability. And so it's all perfectly doable. So got any more questions there, Ed?
Yeah, got at least 2 more good ones. Jim on the webcast says, my question deals with money versus credit, where money comes first, and because of that, credit comes next. What is your view of returning to hard money, a commodity-based money? Although commodity money like gold and silver can be debased, it cannot be perverted as fiat money is today.
Well, I would see it the other way around. I think credit has to come first. And I think it's the idea that we have to get the money somewhere that's the tourniquet on our whole credit system. The idea that you have to dig it out of the ground or you have to borrow it from somewhere else. If you had a public system where you could just issue the national credit, the full faith and credit of the people, that's what we have right now as a currency. Backed by nothing but the full faith and credit of the people. So do like Australia did, do like the Bank of Pennsylvania did, just issue credit for the things you need, or you can issue it as loans, and then if they're what's called self-funding loans, if you're building bridges that have tolls and trains that have fees, et cetera, the loans will pay for themselves. But it's the interest that's the exponential growth that's unsustainable. You can repay a loan, but you got to get the credit out there first. You've got to pay for your workers and materials before you have a product that you can sell and get the money back to pay off the loan.
I totally agree with Ellen. And I think that I feel very missionary about is helping people really understand the politics of money creation and credit allocation. It's time. And we have an hour-long special on ethicalmarkets.tv. You can watch any time you want, which goes into all of this. And I think that this sort of flirting with going back to the gold standard and commodity-based money, it's been tried, the whole idea of baskets of commodities. What I'm afraid, if you do that, it will act like a commodity ETF, and all it will do is drive up the price of food for poor people. So I don't think that that's the way to go. I think the way to go, as Ellen is saying, is to understand what money is and that credit is the primary thing to focus on. Got any more there? Any more questions?
Yeah, sure do. Here's one, kind of bringing it down to an individual level. How does the web of debt apply to us as consumers? How should we use credit in our purchases?
Go ahead, Ellen.
I'm not quite sure what the question is, but I do have an interesting thought on if we had public banks. Do you realize that credit cards take 2 or 3 or 4% of everything we buy with these credit cards? Even if you pay in 30 days, there's actually a surcharge that goes back to the credit card company because the merchant has to pay that. So you don't really, you think, well, I always pay my credit card bill in time, so I'm not paying interest. But you are, because the merchant has to pay it. So what if we had a public bank that had its own credit cards? It would be much cheaper for the people. It would be a nice return for the public entity, which would defray taxes, et cetera. So I'm sorry, I'm afraid I don't really understand the question, but that is one thought I have on credit. We could have our own credit cards. They're making way too much money on those credit cards.
Well, I think, too, that individuals, I think that we're realizing now that we can unravel this very secretive, unbelievably, unnecessarily complex system of money creation and all of the politics around it. And at this point, we really have to support such ideas as those being put out by the Public Banking Institute to get people to understand there's all of these alternatives. And so I would think, you know, that that's one of the things consumers need to do is to really be more political about this. I think that in the next 4 years, we'll probably have another crisis of the global casino because not enough real change has happened. We've still got all these two big to fail banks that are even bigger. And so that what's happening, I think, is that all of these crises of the old money system, you know, that I'm kind of calling peak finance, are driving all of these sensible alternatives. So tap into your local community, publish news every day, you know, of all of these community alternatives, including all of the work that Ellen does. And I think that's what people have to do right now is a look around their own community in their own state and see how they can join up with all these activities that are going on to change the system. Have we got any more there, Ed?
Yeah, let's take a question from the live line. Let's go over to Scott in New York City. Scott, you're live.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for this interview. And Ellen, I love your book, Web of Debt. The content there is amazing, you know, exciting and astonishing and infuriating at times. The content's there. I have a hard time focusing and getting through the whole thing. I have to stand up and walk around. Much of it seems like a marketing issue here. Have you tried, or what's your experience been going to the more traditional / corporate press, like even from PBS, you know, Bill Moyers to, you know, Joe in the Morning, Scarborough in the Morning, and it seems like a lot of these shows often will skirt around similar issues and be open to it, but have you tried? Do they just not even want to go near it, or...
You know what, Scott? I tried very hard to get Bill Moyers to get Alan on the Bill Moyers program, and they actually told me yes, they were definitely going to book her. Has anyone contacted you yet, Alan?
Oh, no. But, you know, I've never actually tried to talk to anywhere. People just come to me. I guess that's a failing of my own, but I'm really a writer. I'm only becoming a speaker because I'm sort of hooked into it. I mean, I'll do it, but in truth, I haven't approached anyone to talk anywhere.
No, I mean, I agree that, you know, Ellen's information is so valuable that, okay, you know, she's better to keep writing and doing her weekly articles than trying to be a self-publicist.
I wish
more people would you know, to shoulder that burden for her, but I want her to keep writing and thinking and researching.
Well, I don't mind speaking, but you know, he said, have I been rejected, but I haven't actually asked.
So we got any more questions? Because we've almost time. We've got 5 more minutes.
Well, we can try taking one more. Don't have any caller ID information for this person, but if you did press *2 to ask a question, I'll put you live. Just say your name.
My name is Sherry.
Hi, Sherry.
Sherry.
Hi. Thank you both so much. I do have a question about the current fiat money system. And is it possible that one of the underlying issues is that there, what we're really talking about is an invented system with printed papers and series of agreements about value and worth based on work or assets or whatever we ascribe to it, if I understand it correctly. It seems to me the whole nature of having a precious metals link of some sort, not as the only underlying link, but to have something, or and it could be anything, that's real, would change the relationship that people have with this whole monetary system. And is that something that you think about, and where does that fall into your thinking?
Well, let me just jump in for a minute, because I'm part of a group in Britain, and Ellen's very involved with this too, a group called the Green Money Working Group. And this is an idea which arose really in Europe, and that was to have a money based on kilowatt hours of solar energy generated electricity. And the whole thing, though, about some commodity to ground the currency, I think the only thing that might be viable at this point is kilowatt hours of electricity from solar. I don't know what you think, Ellen.
Well, to me, the real value of money is the thing you're going to create with it. So it used to be that they had what were called bills of credit, that were, you would basically monetize your invoices. So you had a work product that was coming, and you could turn that into money. Or what you're doing, really, what the bank does is turn the borrower's credit into money. And to me, that is what money really is. It's a negotiable instrument. If you live in a small community, a farming community, let's say, and you go to the grocer and you say, ask for credit until your harvest comes in, your grocer will probably do it because he knows you and he knows there's a harvest coming in. But a stranger wants, or the grocer wants from a stranger, what's called a negotiable instrument, a thing that, you know, verifies that this person's going to pay up and that you know where to find them. In other words, it's a piece of paper that is fungible, that it doesn't matter whether the guy pays up because you can spend this money in the community. So the function of the bank really is to turn people's credit into these little pieces of paper that can be spent in the community. And they don't really, to tie it to a commodity of any sort, it seems to me, ties it down. It's like the euro is a fixed currency system, and we've seen what happened because money generally is all based on debt, so, and the debt is always at interest. So there's always more money owed back than is put out there. but there's only a fixed amount of euros to cover this debt, and so all those countries are in debt, and there's no place to get the extra euros. So I like the idea of a credit-based system.
Yeah, I do too. I really think this chasing after some commodity backing, whether it's gold or silver or, you know, food or oil. And of course, there's a tremendous push now from the old financial system to buy up the last remaining viable natural resources. You know, they're buying up land in Africa, they're buying up forests in the developing countries, and you know, basically, it's just not a viable way to go. It's much better for us to understand how money is created, and then go to credit-backed credit systems. I've studied the whole commodity-based money thing for a long time, and I ended up feeling, you know, that credit is really the primary part of it. It's been a useful exercise to have this discussion about backing a currency with kilowatt hours, because there are many countries, it really started in Iceland, where they have enormous resources coming up out of the ground every day, you know, with the geothermal energy. And when Iceland got these unrepayable debts from its stupid banks, there was an idea that, okay, Iceland could very easily repay that debt in electricity, just by running a high-powered line to Scotland and feeding the Euro grid. So it would be totally doable for them to completely pay off their debt that way. But the Icelandic people just said, hell no, you know, we don't even accept that we owe anything, because it was really our silly banks that did it. And so they rejected the whole idea. For that reason. And, you know, they've gone back to being a fairly local economy now. So this is a real, real turning point, and that's why we all have to finally understand the politics of money creation. And nobody better to have to lead us through it is the great Ellen Brown.
And the great Hazel Henderson.
So I want to thank you so much, Ellen. This is just wonderful. And thank you all for listening, everybody. This was just a wonderful session. And we're all looking forward to your new book, Ellen. The buck starts here. So let's all go out and publicize Ellen's work, okay?
Thank you, Hazel. And thank you for your work.
Thank you so much. All the best.
Bye.
So until next time, I'm Hazel Henderson, and the next session begins in an hour with Donna Hamlin, a very interesting international financial woman, who we're going to talk about what are the responsibilities of company board of directors going through all of these changes. So I hope you'll join us again in an hour. Thank you.